Hello, Blogging Heads Nation. I'm back after a long hiatus by popular demand. It's Dresbert. I'm Heather Hurlburt, Executive Director of the National Security Network.
And I am Daniel Dresner, a Professor of International Politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and also Foreign Policy.
And today we are going to have one of those conversations that everyone always says they want more of, so it'll be interesting to see whether it turns out the public really is crying for this as much as they say they are, where Dan has written a scholarly article on an important policy topic, and we're going to take it, we're going to break down the scholarship, and then we're going to sort of have fun applying it to the real world.
Yes, we are. So this was an interesting article for me. It just came out in the summer issue of International Security. If you go to a link which is probably on the right, whichever way I'm pointing, I'm not sure how this works, it should be available on the Blogging Heads site, and it will be available, I think, for at least the next 4 weeks. And this is a fascinating article to write because it wasn't something I originally sort of felt a burning desire to write. I was approached by an outfit called the Tobin Project, which is designed actually to try to get scholars to talk about real world policy issues. And they basically wanted me to write something on whether or not, for lack of a better way of putting it, the economic benefits of military primacy, were all they were banged up to be. And so I started working on this and thankfully enough, as I was working on this, an article came out in International Security, by Steve Brooks, John Eikenberry, and William Woolforth. A sort of policy version also appeared in Foreign Affairs. And it was a really good article basically saying, look, in fact, there is a overwhelming case to be made for the U.S. military to try to retain military primacy. And by military primacy here, we're talking about basically having the world's biggest military by a good, fair amount, and by deeply engaging with the rest of the world. And that article sort of traced out all the various security and economic benefits that presumably accrued to the United States. So in the article I wrote, which was really almost as much of a lit review as it is a literature review as it was my own research, but basically what I tried to do was figure out, having looked at the arguments being made out there in the policy world about why we're supposed to have such a super awesome military, what ostensibly were the economic benefits from having it? And there are a lot of arguments that are made that have been put out there. And some of them you can sort of bat away very, very quickly. Like, the U.S. has a strong military because, we are extracting oil from everywhere from our, you know, sort of quasi-feudal, subjugated states like Iraq and so forth. And really that can be very easily dismissed. Other arguments are, well, we're doing it for good, proper Keynesian reasons that, you know, having a large military, you know, creates jobs. And the natural counter to that is, the military spending might do that a little bit, but civilian spending does that a whole heck of a lot better, so that's a really bad reason. The three big reasons, the ones
I actually want to stop you there, Dan. Okay. I want to stop you there because you bat that military Keynesianism piece away pretty quickly in the article, but policy-wise, that has enormous staying power. And what's funny is it has enormous staying power among people who ideologically tend to poo-poo every other kind of Keynesianism.
Right.
So it's just worth sort of noting. And the other, there was a very controversial study that came out, it's almost 2 years ago now. It's, I mean, back in the time when sequester was just a bad nightmare that was never, ever, ever going to happen because it wouldn't be allowed to happen because of the military.
Right.
And you had this assertion that that military cuts in Pentagon spending would be incredibly costly to the job base. And only it turns out that it was funded by a defense industry group, which wasn't disclosed initially. And then, as you note in the article, but the case again, I just want to really emphasize this. In fact, if you believe in Keynesianism, military Keynesianism is the worst, is the least effective kind, both because so much of your money is going into hardware, and frankly, because profits at the top of the defense industry are so large. If you want to pursue Keynesian solutions, you build infrastructure, you pay teachers. There's just a zillion things you can spend the money on that produce more jobs than spending it on the military.
Right. I mean, to be clear, I would say there is an argument for military Keynesianism in the sense that if you spend money on the military, will it create jobs? Sure. The question is it the best way to spend the money to create jobs, even if you're a Keynesianism, even if you're a Keynesian? And the answer to that is very clearly no, for a whole variety of reasons, the most obvious of which is also that, you know, you're spending money on investments that can't actually be used in any sort of productive economic way. You know, I mean, when you buy a tank, you've got a tank, that's great. But it's not like that tank can then somehow yield any positive rate of return. Whereas if you, you know, build something like a school or a road, you know, that tends to have greater sort of economic returns. To your point about, you know, that being a hard sell in Washington, I mean, I think we got to be blunt about this. This is this sort of dilemma that the Republican Party finds itself in at this point, which is if you're in a world where you're, I mean, to be fair, I think the GOP's primary argument for, you know, if they want to make a Keynesian argument is just tax cuts, tax cuts, tax cuts. And that can work to a fair extent. But if you're going to push for government spending, that is the one sort of form of government spending that Republicans seem to think is somewhat okay. So I think that's why it's a, I don't think it's an economic question. I think you'd be hard pressed to find economists that could plausibly make the case that military spending was somehow a superior form of sort of producing government jobs than or producing more employment or economic growth than civilian spending. That's just a function of the two-party system at this point, I think.
So I'm going to jump in again really quick on that before we then move on and get to the meat of your argument, because, of course, economists, for better or worse, don't make policy in this area, and you do have – you know, it is very easy to identify people, companies, and groups that actually will lose jobs as a result of changes to Pentagon spending. So, you know, unfortunately, the argument that you and I have just been having is very abstract. And the reality of, you know, the guy that provides the small business that provides water to the Air Force base is very real. And, you know, the other point that you just can't make enough in this context is that military spending, Pentagon spending, has become a proxy by which our political culture measures seriousness on national security. And as we'll get to talking about later, it's a terrible proxy. But the debate that goes on around Pentagon spending doesn't even really have anything to do with, you know, is there in fact a declining value of primacy or a declining marginal return on primacy? And it has everything to do with there is not, or there's only just starting, I would argue, to be a declining political return on primacy rhetoric. How's that?
Yeah, I think you're true. I do think there's an interest. I mean, this is where you can argue potentially that people like Rand Paul or the Tea Party movement are somewhat interesting in that, in some ways, you know, there is a sort of ideological pull for them to at least be more skeptical of defense spending than traditional neoconservatives were. And so, you know, that is going on, and I think you're seeing that slowly emerge. But that said, I also think it's entirely possible, you know, for someone to self-identify as a Tea Partier and still want, you know, an extremely large defense budget. You know, someone like Sarah Palin would certainly fall into that category.
Right. Well, you have the ideological argument gets made that since providing for the common defense is explicitly mentioned in the Constitution, it's okay to spend money on that.
Yes.
Which, you know, is not my way of looking at the world, but it does. I understand how people organize their thinking that way. And it's also worth noting that you're actually seeing some significant shift in the House, where you have a coalition among liberal Democrats who do think that the Pentagon has gotten too big and that the sort of the marginal return is not high enough given the other priorities we have. Libertarians who basically believe the same thing, although obviously what they want to do with the savings is totally different. And we'll talk about this more later, but mainstream folks listening to a significant number of defense and Pentagon insiders who are saying, hey, this culture has gotten out of control and it needs to be reined in. So, in fact, you're getting, and again, you're not getting a lot of wins, but you're getting amendments to cut specific programs or not to add specific things that are getting really big, interesting bipartisan vote totals that they weren't getting, say, two years ago. So the libertarian effect you refer to is having an effect.
The
trick is that, you know, the sort of the neocons can and will whip a majority on any particular issue that they decide is worth pushing back over.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I mean, in some ways, you can argue what happened between the 2001 Budget Control Act and when the sequester kicked in is actually evidence of this. Because, as you said, you know, when the sequester was originally designed in 2011, it was purposefully designed to be as stupid as possible from a policy perspective, because the notion was that only that stupid of a policy would scare everyone involved to thinking, oh, God, we actually have to cut the budget in a, you know, somewhat sensible manner. And as you said, what wound up happening was that, you know, a fair number of libertarians, particularly on the right, were like, you know what? It's not that big of a deal. Why should we don't really see if there's anything to be gained from cooperation just because you cut the Defense Department budget a little more sensibly. I think two other things that have happened, you know, and this might be, again, these are very mild shifts, but I do think there are shifts in the political winds. Is the first is you've seen a host of scandals involving the military, particularly sort of the perks of the four-star general variety. You know, this happened in the fall. You know, I mean, the classic joke was when he was Defense Secretary, Bob Gates saying that, you know, he lived right next to Admiral Mullen when Admiral Mullen was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and that Gates would always blow his leaves into Mullen's yard because he knew that, you know, Gates had to rake his own leaves. But Mullen had a whole staff retinue to do it for him, which kind of pointed out kind of the absurdities that sometimes exist at the upper ranks. And I think you can even argue this week you're starting to see something like this on the bipartisanship with Senators Cruz and Paul deciding they wanted to work with Christian Gillibrand on sexual abuse in the military. And again, I mean, these aren't necessarily just about the budget, but it's almost about, for lack of a better way of putting it, taking the military down a peg in terms of their standing in Washington.
Yeah, I mean, the other place where you've been seeing that for a while, frankly, is the declining currency of military views on national security foreign policy issues, where, you know, we really had sort of a rent-a-general period of American politicking on national security, which, you know, in my view, the moment you can mark that as really coming to a close was when you had two four-star Marine generals write an op-ed in the New York Times urging Congress not to pass, and the president, if it passed, to veto the Defense Authorization Act. So basically saying, veto our own department's authorization over really foolish restrictions on transferring and prosecuting Guantanamo prisoners and future terrorism suspects. And the Hill passed the bill, and the president signed it anyway. And, you know, you had two four-stars, and it didn't, as far as I could see, it didn't change a single vote. So there has been, as is sort of inevitable, I think, in a post-war, even though this is kind of a strange, not post-war, post-war period. But the other point that I really wanted to make, and this gets back to your piece, is that the sort of one fundamental premise of the piece that I would really quibble with is the idea that cutting or reducing or changing Pentagon spending inevitably means giving up U.S. military primacy. And, you know, when you see people like Admiral Mullen coming out and saying, you know, the Pentagon has to be on the table, the Pentagon has to take its share of cuts, you see people, I think Mullen's also the one who said, you know, we have got used to not making hard choices. You know, when you see people like Gates and Hagel who are big fans of American primacy, who are not at all interested in giving up. And, you know, you had Rivlin Domenici and Simpson Bowles both proposed reductions to the Pentagon that would be more than twice what will happen under sequester. So the idea that, you know, I mean, sequester is stupid, but the idea that cuts at the level that are being discussed would somehow destroy U.S. military primacy is just wrong.
Yeah. No. I talk about this a little bit in the conclusion of the piece, but I think the my position would in some ways be very similar, which is, you know, the argument I wind up making is that, first of all, it's entirely possible at this point, the U.S., the extent to which the U.S. outspends everyone else in the world on its defense budget is so large that the U.S. could actually engage the kind of cuts you're talking about. It can have its cake and eat it too. which is it could actually engage in substantive cuts of the defense budget, which would actually lead to sort of genuine cuts in the budget deficit. And it would still be, you know, vastly outspending, you know, all of its possible great power rivals for quite some time. And the other point that I would make is that, you know, really the best way people who want to spend more on the military, the general best way you're going to do that is by actually reviving economic growth, because it's a pretty straight one-to-one correlation between rates of economic growth and rates of defense spending. So the faster that the economy grows, the more likely that you want, you know, you get what economists would call an income effect, which just means you're going to spend a, you know, certain proportion of that money, you know, of the GDP on defense, which means that if the economy grows, you're going to wind up spending more on defense in the long term anyway. So the policy prescription I'm making is you would want to temporarily cut back on defense spending to with the idea that that would presumably help revive economic growth, which would then in turn lead down the road to a sustainable level of defense spending in which the U.S. still retains primacy.
Well, the thing that I think people need to focus in on a little bit, and perhaps this is going to change that correlation in future, is how much Pentagon costs are now being driven by healthcare and retirement benefits.
Yeah, and, no, that's absolutely true.
And so, you know, there is this, if the system continues just as it is and nothing is done, in another 20 or 30 years, the current budget that we have now will only be enough to pay personnel and healthcare costs and retiree costs. So
right. I think it's just called, it's called TRICARE,
yourself,
right?
You know, well, TRICARE is part of, so TRICARE is a retirement benefit
right.
only for people who serve 20 years. So you have, you know, there was this controversy around
yeah.
one of the guys who was one of the SEALs in the Bin Laden raid, who's now retired, is now a veteran and doesn't have health care.
Yeah.
But the trick is, if you stay in 20 years, you have wonderful free or very, very low cost health insurance for the rest of your life. And if you stay in,
right.
you know, 19 years and 6 months, you get nothing. So,
yeah.
So a lot of, again, you know, not crazy peacenik liberals, but military personnel are talking about, let's change the system so that, you know, folks who serve for less than 20 years are getting something out of the deal. And that probably means that folks who serve more than 20 years, you know, have to pay more in co-pays and more in premiums. You know, as many
yeah.
people are now aware, so for example, we employ at National Security Network a veteran who has TRICARE, and thus we don't have to pay for his health insurance, which, you know, is
right.
lovely for us. And this is hard, because if you're willing to go out and get killed for your country, we do owe you, and you are willing to be injured, you are willing to be in all kinds of conditions that we wouldn't allow civilian workers to be in, your country owes you something, and specifically if your country promises you health care for the rest of your life, your country doesn't want to go back on that promise. But there
yeah.
are lots of people who, you know, to talk about reforming those aspects of the system to provide both, you know, more resources for more people who serve, and also, frankly, to make sure there's enough money left over to actually, you know, have a military.
Right. I mean, this also points out that, I mean, in some ways, what I was doing in the article was talking about simultaneously sort of military primacy in terms of large defense budgets, but also sort of an active engagement with the rest of the world. It's possible that you could spend a ton on the military but not decide not to use it or deploy it anywhere. But the simple fact is the two tend to go hand in hand, particularly in the case of the United States. You know, I think the statistic is that in the post-Cold War era, in which conflict as a general rule has declined across the globe, the U.S. has still been at war, I think, more than half the years of the post-Cold War period. In fact, yeah, and obviously since Afghanistan started, we've been at war continuously. So, you know, one of the other issues here is that in some ways it does become a policy issue, where if you're trying to assess the cost of Iraq or Afghanistan or a future conflict, you're right, you're also going to have to add the long-term healthcare costs. And again, it's one of these good news, bad news things, because you can argue that the reason why this is costing more than it used to is that a lot fewer soldiers die now than used to in war. It's worth remembering that, you know, we had an 8-year war with Iraq in which less than 5,000 soldiers were killed. In Vietnam, on the other hand, you had more than 50,000. die in you know, the same period of time. And you go back to the Civil War, and you're talking about 500,000 dead, mostly from infection. So, you know, on the one hand, it's good news because medical science has improved to the point where you can save a lot of people that would otherwise have died. On the other hand, these people are wounded and carry a lot of scars, both physical and psychological, and so that means longer-term spending on them, which, again, I think is probably worth it, but it is something you have to calculate now.
Well, you want to be careful, Dan, because that is a factor, but the other factor is just that we're all living longer in general. So you may have been in the military for 20 years, never seen a combat tour. You know, suppose you get in when you're 20, get out when you're 50. When the policies were developed, you know, maybe you were going to live, you know, you're a man. Maybe you smoked. You were going to live to 65 or 70. Now you're highly likely to live past 80. And, you know, gerontology is more expensive for the same reasons that we are able to keep more people alive after battlefield injuries. We're able to keep more older people alive. So it's very, you know, you don't want to frame this in a way that says, oh, you know, too many people are surviving wars. But it's just
right. No,
general,
I don't mean.
It's the same pattern that we're seeing in civilian healthcare. You know, it's the same reason that we had the healthcare reform fight on the civilian side. That just the costs, because of the good news that we can all live longer, healthier, more productive lives. Or not all. Sorry, that's scientifically false. That on average we're living longer, more healthy, and productive lives.
Okay, let me warn you. We are now, as we are skirting into healthcare, going to what I like to call my policy kryptonite. Which is, I can't talk about healthcare to save my life.
Let's back off and go back to engagement, which I think is important because something else that that we just fell into a trap that really pervades the American media, which we talk about, oh, American engagement with the world, but what you really meant was military engagements, otherwise known as wars. And one of the other points you make in the piece, which I think is critically important and not well understood, is there are multiple kinds of primacy. There's military primacy, there's economic primacy, and you make a really interesting point about their interrelationship, and that basically you argue that military primacy with perceptions of declining economic primacy buys you fewer and fewer economic goods, and so the other half of your argument is, let's focus less on military forms of engagement or leadership and more on economic forms of engagement or leadership, which will then, you say, make our military leadership more meaningful. Have I got that right in layperson terms?
Sort of. I'll finish the summary very quickly. So,
that was savage, ladies and gentlemen.
Sorry.
PE masters and I are duly rebuked.
Here's what I would argue. So there are three arguments out there for why military primacy is worth it, you know, in terms of just strictly economic benefits. The first is that this sort of what I call the geoeconomic favoritism argument, which says if you have the world's strongest military, private capital thinks, wow, it must be really secure where you are. Therefore, we're going to invest where you are because you're so safe and secure. And to put it bluntly, there's almost no evidence for this whatsoever. There's no denying that capital likes to go to places where there's strong protection of property rights and so on and so forth. You do not need the world's strongest military, to have that kind of protection, as the case of Switzerland would suggest. The second argument is geopolitical favoritism. It's the notion here that in some ways there's a quid pro quo. The U.S., by offering, its security umbrella to key allies, like, let's say, Saudi Arabia, or Japan, those countries in turn subsidize U.S. spending on the military, either through direct transfers or through paying for military bases and so forth, or for supporting, let's say, the dollar as the world's reserve currency. And these things certainly happen. Again, however, the evidence is not that strong that you need to be the military superpower to get that. In fact, actually, the evidence suggests that this was a much more powerful effect between the United States and its allies during the Cold War period. During the post-Cold War period, where U.S. military predominance has been unchallenged, there's no denying that you know, Japan and Saudi Arabia have, let's say, supported the U.S. dollar. So, however, has China, which is presumably one of our potential rivals. So that argument doesn't work terribly well, and it also doesn't work terribly well if you look at things like trade patterns and so forth. Now, the last one, which is what you were just talking about, is the sort of public goods argument. And those of you who have taken International Relations 101, it's also called the theory of hegemonic stability. The basic argument here is that if you have an uncontested military superpower, that's very clarifying for the world. So everyone knows who the most powerful country in the world is. There is seemingly no point in challenging that country. Therefore, countries don't engage in things like arms races or things like that. Also, the world's most powerful country can presumably provide things, global public goods in the form of, let's say, protecting against or anti-piracy operations, or just generally preventing chaos from ensuing. Now, there is evidence for this. This is probably the strongest argument in favor of military primacy. And if you compare, let's say, what, spending on defense, for example, during the Cold War and aggregate spending on defense post-Cold War, there's evidence that, in fact, the existence of the U.S. as a military hegemon actually did tamp down military spending as a general rule. The problem, and here we get to the point you were talking about, Heather, is that primacy is not just about military power alone. In some ways, you need what I call full spectrum unipolarity, which is you need to be recognized as not just the hegemon in terms of military force, but also in terms of economic influence. And even scholars who have argued that unipolarity brings stability acknowledge that if it's unclear that a particular country has, hegemony in one dimension, it's going to cause a lot of, it's going to cause uncertainty. So countries start competing. That although everyone is sort of very clear right now that the U.S. still retains military primacy, whether or not the U.S. retains economic primacy is actually, there's a fair amount of confusion on that. In fact, just today, Pew Global Attitudes came out with a survey sort of showing that, asking citizens across the world, who do you think is the world's leading economic power? And what's very interesting is that there's a little bit of schizophrenia on this. If you ask Americans, a plurality, actually I think now a majority will say China. If you ask the Chinese, a plurality will say the United States. And that, in fact, if you look at the G7, responses in the G7 economies, there are either strong majorities or pluralities that believe that China is the world's leading economic power. But if you ask a lot of the developing world, they will answer China.
No, you don't mean China. Like in Africa, it was something like only 39% thought China was the dominant power, and the rest thought it was.
If you ask the G7, they say China. If you ask the developing world, a lot of them still say the United States. And the truth is, I'm furiously trying to finish a book right now on post-2008 global economic governance, so I actually took a very close look at these sorts of power questions. The U.S. is still vastly more powerful than China, and it's not close, frankly. But in some ways, that doesn't matter. What matters is what the perception is.
Well, and also relative power, that people see in the developed world that China is much more powerful than it was, and that they feel, or we feel, and I think this is what explains the American numbers, that Americans feel much less powerful than we felt 10, 15 years ago, and we therefore assume that there's a one-for-one trade and that if we've lost, somebody's gained at our expense, and who can you identify? China.
Well, and in some ways that's true. Relatively speaking, we are less powerful than we were 10 or 15 years ago. There's no denying that. On the other hand, we were really a lot more powerful than everyone else 10 or 15 years ago. We're still more powerful than China. But there's no denying that in terms of a relative sense, China has gained, not necessarily at the expense of the United States, but power is a relative measure in most situations. So, if the U.S. has lost, China has gained. But that said, China is still lacking on a number of dimensions, compared to the United States. So they're still not as powerful as the United States. They're simply more powerful than they used to be. The problem is that, you take a look at things like China's growth numbers, and so forth, and people tend to do the kind of sort of straight line extrapolation into the future that, as you and I are familiar with, people did with Japan back in the late 80s. So the point here, though, is that because there's so much confusion about this, as a result, the presumed benefits that you get from military primacy start to fade away. If the U.S. is no longer seen as the sole superpower, the fact that it has military primacy doesn't net it all that much. Now, I would also point out that if it was reversed, if the U.S. was seen as the economic superpower but lacking in military resources, you'd have the same problem. But the point being that at this juncture, the issue for the United States, if it really wants to sort of gain all the benefits it presumably wants from primacy, you know, from primacy, is that it needs to persuade everyone else that, in fact, it is still the most powerful economy in the world. It is entirely possible that just on its own the United States will do this. You know, the U.S. has done relatively well post-2008 compared to the developed world. And I think in some ways the Pew surveys were done before, you know, people began to realize, particularly in the last 6 weeks or so, that, that China's growth model might actually be sort of running out of steam, as it were. But the point is that if, you know, if you were to revitalize the American economy and get, you know, higher growth rates, that would also naturally sort of eventually shift these kinds of perceptions as well. So the argument I'm making in the end is that if you want to get the benefits from military primacy, you have to convince both Americans and everyone else, more importantly everyone else, that America's economic engine is also still running relatively smoothly.
I mean, so two things. One, just that argument that you just made, you hear very frequently from senior American military personnel who, you know, will say to you very strongly, the economy is the foundation of U.S. military primacy.
Right.
But sort of a bigger think question that I was moved to pose by reading your piece is that in a way your analysis assumes that the definitions and relative importance of military primacy and economic primacy have stayed static over the period that you look at. And I'm dubious right. about that. And in particular, so with military primacy in the post-Cold War era, because of the democratization, I don't really like that word, because of the spread and ease or the difficulty for the state to retain its monopoly on the use of force. How about that? Military
yeah.
primacy is just less meaning because you can be you can have great military superiority and yet be quite militarily vulnerable in ways that were not true, you know, in the same way in the past. So that sort of makes me wonder whether you're actually in some sense comparing apples and oranges if you look at, you know, relative military and economic primacy in 2010 versus 1990 versus 1970 versus 1930, let's say.
Right. I would say two things on this. First, there's no denying that there are ways in which the utility of military force or military power has changed over the years. I mean, the good old-fashioned traditional way that military power got you economic gain back in the, you know, in the 1800s and before, was just out-and-out imperialism, which is you occupied a territory, you know, stripped it of all its resources, shipped it back to the metropole, and profited from that. And there's a fair amount of evidence that in a lot of places, imperialism was profitable for the country actually engaging in the imperialism. As you say, that you just couldn't do that nowadays. It would be extremely difficult in the amount of blowback you would get from attempting to do that would be next to impossible. So I agree with you that there are some ways in which I think military the fungibility of military power, would be a good way of putting it, has become restricted. There are certain things you can't do with the use of force that you could in the past. As to your point about, you know, even if you have the world's most powerful military, are you still insecure? You know, that kind of gets to a psychological question as much as it does an international relations question, because, you know, your point about, well, you know, non-state actors can render the United States, you know, increasingly fragile, you know, you have to point out that between the September 11th attacks and, let's say, the Boston Marathon bombing earlier this year, there have only been very isolated instances of terrorism. And you can argue that at least in some small part, that was presumably due to the fact that the U.S. was able to project military power abroad and, you know, do it presumably a somewhat credible job of guarding its borders. And I think I'd have to add, we were just really lucky.
I would also argue, you know, that the fact that we were able to project an enormous amount of military power into Iraq and Afghanistan but not produce anything that looks like a win in traditional terms actually significantly weakens perceptions of our primacy, both militarily and economically, and that, you know, while Iraq and Afghanistan, you're absolutely right, didn't pose any kind of existential threat. The wars didn't pose any kind of existential threat to the United States. The fact that we spent all that money and blood and treasure there and didn't didn't produce unambiguous, clear-cut, old-fashioned surrender in the Bay of Japan wins, actually hurt global perceptions of our primacy, and that's sort of an example of what military primacy doesn't buy you. I mean, in the same way, I'm just back from a week in Israel-Palestine, so I found it very interesting to apply your argument sort of regionally, and in the same way that, you know, the Israelis have amazing military primacy. It can't, however, yeah. stop every rocket coming in from Gaza. That has political consequences, it has economic consequences, and it has long-term consequences on it's both allowed Israel to develop its economic primacy, which is quite extraordinary, and it's going to limit Israel's ability to develop its economic primacy further. So I do think that, you know, it's the way that military primacy has changed or is limited by the growth and capacity of non-state actors isn't quite the same thing as your ability to defend your core national interests.
That might be fair, but I mean, there are counters to what you were saying, which would be there are also evidences of the U.S. use of military force, you know, in the last couple of years that actually you could argue have enhanced, you know, U.S. reputation, yep. at least in terms of military power. I mean, obviously, you know, the killing of Osama bin Laden and the use of special forces to, you know, get in and out of Pakistan without the Pakistanis, you know, even being aware of it. Even the Pakistanis, you know, apparently there's that leaked report in which they're just still, they'll still sort of flabbergasted that the U.S. was able to pull that off. You know, the use of drones and automated weapons would also be another potential example of this. And a third one, you know, which was a couple of years ago, but would still matter, would be the use of the U.S. Navy to assist in the case of, you know, things like humanitarian disasters like the tsunami in late 2004 and early 2005. But you're right. I mean, in some ways, that this is off topic from the paper, but I think you're correct that there are certain applications of military force nowadays that don't yield the same benefits that they used to, because frankly, we prosecute wars very differently than we used to.
So the reason that I'm an inside the Beltway policy advocate rather than a Boston environs professor is that I actually think both things can be true at the same time. But
I will accept that. No, and as I said, as you point out, the very fact that I was talking about, well, it's a real problem that, you know, people are living longer during war, you know, or, you know, not enough people are dying in wars or something. You know, I didn't obviously mean that, but the very fact that I even phrased it partially that way suggests that I'm very well situated in Boston as opposed to inside.
I'm afraid I need to wrap up. But this has been, has been a great session. And I do, you know, as somebody who, you know, thinks in one paragraph or less these days, kudos to the folks who engage academics to try to take an extensive literature and turn it into something that can be thought about in a paragraph at a time.
Well, I'll encourage all policy wonks to read the article. It is, I think, pretty accessible. I think it was written in pretty jargon-free English, as these things go. And again, thanks to the Tobin Project for giving me the opportunity.
Good to talk to you, and till next time. And go Red Sox.
Heather, always
go Red Sox in the second half.
Yes, go Red Sox. We didn't even get to talk about the Red Sox, which, you know, maybe that's just as well.
Geez,
we don't want to talk about
gloating.
The Red Sox.
It's too early to gloat. See you in September.
Yes, absolutely. Very true.
Bye-bye.
All right, stay cool.